This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and as always, I'm here with my colleague Susan Simpson, and this week we also have a great guest. But first, hello, Susan.
Hey, Rabia.
How are you doing?
I am doing fantastic. I actually am got to see my family for the first time since 2019.
We
quarantined for 2 weeks and then got to see him this weekend, and it was fabulous. So
that's great. I'm so glad you got a chance to do that.
Yeah.
Well, my husband also got a chance to do that with his family in Canada after testing and quarantining and all that. And I'm glad they did that too. But we're joined today by Professor Mike Klarman. He's a Kirkland and Ellis professor at the Harvard Law School. After law school, Professor Klarman clerked for the Honorable Ruth Bader Ginsburg on a U.S. Court of Appeals to the D.C. Circuit. He then joined the faculty at the University of Virginia School of Law in 1987 and served there until 2008 as the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law and History. Incredibly distinguished guest, I must say.
And we brought him on this week because he recently released a foreword called The Degradation of American Democracy and the Court, in which he outlines a very comprehensive review of not only the Trump era, which we've covered on the show, but also the larger forces leading up to Trump, and the Republican Party's current predicament, and how that affects the very striking decline of democracy in America today. And more importantly, he traces out what is likely to happen going forward, particularly in regards to the Supreme Court, and how the Supreme Court is likely not going to be the answer to the issues facing America today.
Well, I got to say, from the title and also having had a conversation, It's hard to feel too optimistic. But anyhow, we're going to get to this conversation, which is fantastic, and I can't wait to have him back on. But let's first do what we normally do, which is at the top of the show, start with where we are with COVID. All right, so we're just breaking records every day. We have an average.
Woo, we're number one.
We're number
one. Go America.
We totally are. We hit the highest death toll in the world, 1,000 dead every day, 44,000 new cases a day. We are at almost 190,000 deaths in the United States. I'm sure we'll break that by tomorrow or next couple of days.
It's not so much like a wave of pandemics in the U.S. It's more like a flood.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one steady surge.
As schools have reopened, more than 51,000 cases have been reported at more than 1,000 campuses. And listen, the school year just started. It was just reported yesterday that the coronavirus cases are rising in 22 of our states. However, interestingly enough, where we saw the biggest number of cases early on, California, Texas, Florida, they have had a decrease in rates, probably because they've been really careful in shutting down. But we're seeing a lot of rise of cases in like the Midwest and stuff.
Or Georgia, Alabama, just chugging right along. No decrease there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, God. South Dakota had the biggest increase over the past 2 weeks, 126% increase, because probably of that insane motorcycle rally that happened in Sturgis, South Dakota for I don't know what. That's just an annual rally, and they were like, we're not postponing it this year. So,
or wearing masks, because that's how they roll.
That's right. They did not wear masks. They had concerts. They did parades like every day up and down the street. I feel bad for that town, but I hope the people who... the locals were able to just like hide from them.
There has indeed been increased spread, not just South Dakota, but across the U.S. because of this rally. And one study estimating the outbreak traced to the Sturgis rally came to the conclusion that the total cost in terms of healthcare and other damages from this rally amounts to $12.2 billion, I think it was. Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Yeah, because these people took it all the way back to wherever they came from.
They took it everywhere.
Oh, my Lord. All right.
But the one optimistic note, sort of, is that the study also found that in regions where there were strong precautionary measures in place, the total increase from the Sturgis rally was, much more manageable as opposed to states where there were not such precautions, which had up to 17% increases in rates directly attributable to the Sturgis rally.
Well, look, we are now, I was just doing the math. I was like, in the bathroom earlier today, I'm like, wait a minute, how many months has it been? We're like in month 6, 7 of this, quarantine. It's just, it just feels like now we're at the point where America's like, yeah, we're just gonna live with it. We're just gonna ride this until maybe it goes away, maybe it doesn't. But it's just, I just feel like the government's given up. I mean, they just don't.
They have. The odds of us, I mean, at least the vaccine development seems to be genuinely moving ahead. Now there's the whole issue of whether it's being perhaps overly accelerated for Trump's political interest. But the aside from that, there doesn't be reason for optimism for the vaccine. So at this point, it does seem like the U.S. has just taken the, you know, fuck it, it's too late. Let's just
keep on chugging. We just got to keep going, and then a vaccine will come, and whoever survives it, survives it, and the rest of us get vaccines. Trump recently said that he believes or hopes that there will be a vaccine by the election. Okay, and this morning we had Trump's spokesperson blame the previous administration for the lack of vaccine. So let's take a listen to this.
Through bureaucratic barriers so we can get a safe, effective, and timely vaccine. And once again, compare that to Obama-Biden, where they promised a vaccine, they vastly underperformed, and you have Biden's advice.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not only was Obama responsible for not having a testing program in place for a virus that didn't exist for 3 years after he left office, he is now also responsible for not having a vaccine yet. But, so, with the caveat that the vaccine is extremely important and that we need to have it and have wide acceptance of it as soon as possible. There are part of the problem what Trump is doing right now is that he's causing a large percentage or a large enough percentage of the population to have doubts about this vaccine, which I would argue that's
because he's come out so quickly. So people are
I want to push back against that because I think that's probably the most harmful thing that could happen. And Trump's making it worse by announcing that he's going to have it by November 1st. But on the other hand, we recently have concerning signs from the FDA about how much they've been co-opted by the Trump administration. On our last show, we discussed complex in plasma and how what seemed like it could be a potential new therapy, although like the FDA was grossly overstating its effectiveness that was shown in the limited studies that we had. Like, okay, maybe this is something that's real. And they had a whole press conference to talk about how it's so great. Well, there finally has been a proper study done of the plasma therapy.
So depressing.
Yeah, a proper double-blind, the kind of study that actually is a study that actually has scientific value, and it found that convalescent plasma has no effect on COVID survival rates.
Oh my lord.
Yeah, after all of that brouhaha from the FDA and their inability to understand how stats work, it seems like that therapy was also bunk. At least, unlike hydroxychloroquine, it doesn't kill you.
On the vaccine front, something pretty much unprecedented happened, and this is again in the face of what you know the uncertainty and fear that Trump is causing by scaring people about the vaccine. 9 biopharmaceutical companies signed a joint pledge to uphold high ethical standards, suggesting they're not going to seek premature government approval for COVID-19 vaccines. That's never happened before, but that's what it's going to take for people to actually trust the vaccine. Although, will they really trust the pharma? I don't know.
That's like the opposite of like why we have government. We have government because
we want to have. I know.
And now we're like, okay, well, government's not working, so now the corporations themselves are going to try and band together to reassure consumers. Like, okay, well, I guess it's better than nothing, but also this is not how effective.
Yeah. And this is not a sector. Look, this is not a sector that a lot of people trust anyways.
Trust so. Like, okay, you know, trust. Maybe sure, it's nicer doing this, but also. That's why we have an FDA in the first place.
We need a group of nuns to like sign a joint pledge with them.
Nuns with PhDs and right. In vaccines.
All right. Speaking of unprecedented, was it this morning or yesterday that Trump just basically attacked top military brass?
Biden shipped away our jobs, threw open our borders, and sent our youth to fight in these crazy endless wars. And it's one of the reasons the military, I'm not saying the military is in love with me, the soldiers are. The top people in the Pentagon probably aren't because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy. But we're getting out of the endless wars. You know how we're doing.
All right. So this comes in the wake of some explosive reporting by The Atlantic. And then it was confirmed by multiple outlets. It was reported on Fox, you know, by a journalist who also confirmed the sources about Trump's disdain for service members in the military. And I mean, you know, this again, over and over again, it's like you, something like this comes out and you're like, this has to end a presidency. This is presidency ending.
He said it in 2015 and didn't do shit, obviously. So,
I mean, in 2015, okay, so he's been attacking John McCain forever, right? This is another level, though, because he's saying, like, he did not want, in 2018, remember when he was supposed to, like, go visit an American military cemetery outside of Paris? He didn't show up. People were like, oh, it was raining, it was his hair. And he's like, oh, no, it was weather. Well, it turns out, according to these sources, that he thought he said the dead soldiers were losers and suckers and did not want, again, the rain to mess up his hair. Which, to call dead service, I mean, like, it's beyond reprehensible, shocking. I can't even wrap my mind around it. And there's actual, like, silence from the GOP on this.
Because those who believe it don't need this article to know how he feels, because he's made it abundantly clear. And those who do support Trump aren't going to believe it no matter what. So its ability to actually change anything or move the needle, probably not there.
I mean, he's just come out and called it. He's like, it's his lies. That's his, I mean, he's just basically, he's not even saying that, well, yeah, I mean, he's out. He even had the gall to say, I never called John McCain a loser. I mean, he tweeted
that. And like you did. And like you tweeted about how you called him a loser like several years ago. It's also, I mean, just even before even after the election, remember when he called the widow of a soldier who had died in action in 2017 and was rude and dismissive, insulted her. And even then we had John Kelly come out and defend Trump in this, and just attack anyone who criticized Trump's handling of it. And of course, this whole story, guess who it basically certainly comes from? John Kelly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not official, but like everyone knows it's from John Kelly. And it's his attempt in some way. I mean, it seems like this, well, one, it seems like this is an attempt by John Kelly to try and rehab his image and try and make a place for himself in respectable society by showing, hey, look, I was not always subservient to Trump all the time.
Too little, too late. I mean, something.
Yeah. But also, some of these comments from Trump were apparently made at the gravesite of his son who died in action.
Oh, my God, that's right. Oh, my God.
Which I'm sure is
right. Because Trump said, as he's standing next to John Kelly at the grave of his son, he's saying, I don't understand what people do in the military. Why do they do this? Why would you give your life for the country? That's what he said.
Well, for Trump, too, it's not just about like him insulting service members. It's him wanting to brag about how he was so talented and smart and clever for getting out of Vietnam with his bone spurs.
So I recently lost like two pairs of shoes to my eldest daughter who moved out, and she took her Rothy's with her.
Oh no.
Yeah, she did. She's been eyeing them ever since I've got them.
Oh no.
Yeah. And look, for those of you who had not heard of Rothy's, look, this is a company that's making stylish, sustainable shoes and bags made for life on the go. They are carefully crafted with eco-friendly materials. It's amazing. They're made out of repurposed plastic, water bottles, and marine plastic.
Shoes are not my thing. I don't pay attention to it. I never heard of Rothy's until we tried them. And now I'm like a hardcore fan for life.
I love them.
It's the only shoe I'll like evangelize for. I'm like, have you tried these? They're really comfy and they look cool.
Yeah. I will say this. When I did have my Rothy's, because I have to get more, and I wore them, people ask me, are those Rothy's? I'm like, yes, they are. And that's because they're also beautiful. They have tons of chic styles to choose from, and they change the styles all the time. And they're just the perfect pair for literally any adventure. You can wear them kind of anywhere.
You know what? No one's stolen my Rothy's, but I think I deserve new ones too. So I will join you in getting new Rothy's.
Well, their newest styles also include brand new bags. And I love me a nice bag, so I know I'm getting one. Masks and their first adjustable sneaker. Oh, I'm so excited.
Oh.
Yep, the lace-up is an out-of-this-world comfortable shoe, and as with all their shoes, it's knit from thread made from repurposed plastic water bottles.
And guess what, guys? Rothy's are machine washable.
Amazing. Amazing. All right, so check out all the amazing shoes and bags available right now at rothys.com/45th. That's Rothy's, rothys.com/45th. Style and sustainability meet to create your new favorites.
So head to rothys.com/45th today.
That's some quick updates. Of course, there's plenty of other horrible, reprehensible things that have happened. However, we had a great interview with a professor, so let's just get right to it. Welcome to the show, Professor Klarman. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, your paper, The Degradation of American Democracy, that I read, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was an amazingly comprehensive review of the Trump era and beyond, and had some great points about the Supreme Court's role in all of this, as well as certain U.S. factors that are contributing to our current declining democracy. So in your paper, you talk about how the demographics in America have contributed to this and the current, positioning of the Republican Party. One thing you commented on is that in the modern world, there really aren't a lot of democracies that are have an extremely integrated population.
Well, so you think about the United States as being a long-time democracy, but the United States was only a democracy for white people for most of its history. African Americans were mostly enslaved until the Civil War. They briefly were given the right to vote, but then it was pretty quickly taken away from them. And it's only since the 1960s that the Voting Rights Act has turned the United States back into a full democracy. And African Americans, basically the demography of the country in 1950 was 90% white, 10% black. Half of African Americans lived in the South, where most of them were disenfranchised. So there's not, and the demographics today are very different. The United States is less than 60% white. Latinos are the largest minority racial or ethnic group at something like 17%. African Americans are about 12%. Asian Americans are 5 or 6%, growing very quickly. The United States is no longer a predominantly white country. And because of the way various groups vote, beginning with Obama's coalition of the ascendant, you don't need to win the white vote to become president. Obama lost the white vote by 20 percentage points in 2012, but he was still elected president because he won 85% of the vote from the 28% of the non-white voting population. And that's the trend. The United States will not be majority white another 20 years. And the Republican Party, increasingly, rather than remaking itself, which they thought about doing after the 2012 election, rather than remaking themselves, they moved in Trump's direction, which is a pretty openly racist party. And obviously, they're not going to win a lot of non-white votes. They need to squeeze out as many additional white votes as they can to remain in power. And that just gets more difficult. So the only way really to do it is to start suppressing votes, which they've been doing pretty aggressively for the last 15 or 20 years.
I remember after 2012 when they had the GOP had the post-election report, and they had aspirations of becoming a big tent party. And instead, they seem to have gone the exact opposite direction.
Yeah, so they had a post-mortem, and the post-mortem said we got to be better at appealing to women and Latinos and young people. I don't think the post-mortem talked much about appealing to African Americans. I think they regard African Americans pretty much as a lost cause. They haven't won more than about 10% of African American votes since they nominated Barry Goldwater in 1964. So there were people who definitely wanted to move in that direction, even some surprising people. I think I remember reading in one of the secondary sources I used that, you know, even people like Rush Limbaugh was talking about the party reaching out to Latinos. Certainly, somebody like Rubio did. That's why he supported immigration reform legislation. Trump kind of recognized something. I'm loath to call him a political genius because I don't think he's a genius at anything. But I do think he had a certain instinctive understanding that there were very large percentages of Republican-leaning voters who are increasingly racially resentful, partly because of democracy, but also partly because of the first African-American president. And it's quite clear from the political science literature that the best predictor of Trump doing well in the primary among voters was with the most racially resentful voters, the voters who wanted to expel all 11 million undocumented immigrants and those who wanted a complete ban on Muslim immigration. Those were the ones who are most likely to vote for Trump. And then in the general election, Trump won by exactly the same 20% margin among white voters that Romney did, but it was a very different group of white voters. It was the non-college educated white voters who went for Trump by 40 to 50 percentage points. And that's, again, the people who tend to be the most racially resentful. And, you know, there was a lot of commentary after the election that this is about economic conditions, it's about trade deals, it's about losing factory jobs. But it turns out it's actually mostly about racial resentment.
Professor Klarman, can I ask a question? Is that okay? My question is, so You know, with Trump, I mean, I certainly don't think he has or ever had any grasp on, like, you know, what the pulse of the GOP or any. I mean, he really just has a grasp of his own instinct and he just goes with it. But for the GOP to align itself behind Trump, like, they're banking that this agenda, this highly racialized agenda, this highly divisive agenda, this is what's going to keep them in power versus the postmortem show that they really need to reach out and be more inclusive.
How long can this last? Yeah,
right. That's what I'm saying. Like, what are the numbers behind? Do they really think there's, are they imagining that there are vast, you know, there are vast populations of Americans who just don't vote? So maybe this will bring them out, the white voters who actually don't vote. And if we stoke up enough fear, then maybe they'll come forward and vote. I mean, is that what they're banking on?
That's a great question. And, you know, I'll give you an answer, but I'm not a political theorist. I don't know what's going on in their head. I think that if you're thinking long term, any Republican strategist understands that this is a losing strategy. To a large extent, they're just stuck with Trump and the fact that 90% of Republicans not only think he's doing a fine job, but actually a lot of them think he's the greatest president in their lifetime. You know, 53% of Republicans, according to one poll, think that Trump is a better president than Abraham Lincoln, who was surely our greatest president. The Republican politicians are scared of Trump because he dominates the Republican Party. The base absolutely loves him. And anybody who criticizes him will not only be primaried immediately and have, you know, if you're Susan Collins, you understand that to be reelected in Maine, you need to win some votes in the middle. But until the primaries are over, if you alienate Trump supporters, you're not going to be nominated in the Republican Party. 2018 showed that, right? The people who Trump criticized went down the ignominious defeat. So Republican politicians are scared to death of him. And in addition to that, even retiring politicians like that guy in the congressman in Southwest Florida, who initially said, you know, he was troubled by the phone call, the shakedown phone call to Ukraine, and he thought maybe he'd vote in favor of an impeachment inquiry.
Right.
You know, he was retiring. And they just made his life so miserable. It's not just your political calculation of getting reelected. Do you want to be turned into, do you want to be ostracized by your friends and neighbors, get hated on social media, maybe get death threats? I think they mostly just figure it's not worth it. So it's not elected politicians, except for Mitt Romney, who is this unusual character from Utah, where because the Mormons don't really like Trump very much, because unlike most of Trump's base, the Mormons actually have a lot of sympathy for religious minorities, having known a lot of victimization in their own history, so they're not likely to support the Muslim ban. Other than someone like Mitt Romney, who's protected, there just aren't a lot of, you know, there just aren't many Republican politicians who are willing to stand up to him. But there are, you know, Republican strategists, there are Republican pundits, former, you know, people who don't have to worry about getting reelected and are willing to occasionally just see what's in front of their face and realize this guy's a terrible threat to democracy. So I'm talking about the Jeff Flakes and the Bill Kristols and the Stuart Stevens, who wrote a terrific book saying, you know, he goes further than most of them. Stuart Stevens has played a role in electing every Republican president in the last 40 years, and he says it was all a lie. It was all a lie. It's always been about race. You know, go back to Ronald Reagan, who opened his general election campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were murdered in the summer of 1964. And that was a signal to, you know, white Mississippians, hey, the Republican Party's your friend. We're not going to be imposing forced busing on you. We're not going to be imposing affirmative action on you. So anyway, it's a rambling answer to the question, but I don't think that this is a strategic calculation, that this is the right policy to win in 20 years. They have to hope that through voter suppression and getting even more rural whites in Wisconsin to turn out who don't usually vote, and the Electoral College, right? I mean, Trump has almost no chance of winning the popular vote. He has a decent chance of winning the Electoral College.
Yeah. And in addition to the usual tactics of, you know, voting rights, attacks on that, attempts to, you know, purge voter rolls, this year, of course, we have the census on top of everything, which will not only have huge repercussions on how politics plays out in the United States, it'll be for the next 10 years before we can fix it again. So whatever happens in November 3rd, the census results will stick with us. And that can also have a negative effect on democracy, our hopes for it there.
So let me say two things about what they're trying to do with the census, and then I just think the Democrats may need to redo the census. And
is that be possible? Is that
I'm sure there'll be a legal challenge. And when there's a legal challenge, the question is, what does the Supreme Court think? And the Supreme Court thinks what the Republican Party thinks, which is why Democrats, I think, need to start thinking about reforming the court. But I would think you could make a pretty good argument, since they're obviously systematically trying to undermine the census. I think you could make an argument that we should do it again. So just in case the listeners don't know, there are two things they're trying to do here. One is they're trying to undercount Latinos, because that means you'll get less political, you'll get fewer seats in Congress and fewer electoral college votes to states with large numbers of Latino populations. So the Constitution is clear that the apportionment is based on persons, but if people are not responding to the census, say you're a Latino American who's a citizen, but maybe you have family members in your family household who are undocumented, you may choose not to answer because you're worried about those people. So they're trying to drive down the numbers. And of course, that's used not only to distribute political power, but also federal money. The other thing that they're doing is they're setting the groundwork for starting to apportion not based on persons, but based only on citizens. So the Constitution says when you're awarding a certain number of congressional representatives to Texas or to California, you do that based on the number of persons, not the number of citizens. But when Texas itself is deciding how to draw up its 35 or however many congressional districts there are, it's not clear that they're bound to do that based on persons as opposed to having the choice to do it on citizens. So then again, you know, Texas would be ripped off because Texas has a lot of Latinos who would be undercounted. But when you're distributing political power within Texas, where there's another effort by whites desperately to hang on to power in a state that's no longer majority white, they're going to start doing the apportionment based not on persons, but on citizens, which means that cities like San Antonio and Houston and Dallas will end up getting shortchanged in favor of rural areas, which are disproportionately white. So that's what they're trying to do. And they've been, you know, the first they tried to do it through the census question, which the Supreme Court, thanks to a last minute change of heart by Justice Roberts, said, no, you can't do. Now they're just going to stop counting arbitrarily in late September, although I think a federal court just issued an injunction, but we'll see how that does on appeal. You know, if they're successful at doing it, we have ways of estimating. And if it's obvious that they've undercounted by several millions, I think the Biden administration should just redo it and dare the Supreme Court to strike that down.
I feel like they would take up that dare, though, given the recent string of results we've had this year alone. It seems like there has been unanimously coming against voting rights. Is that fair to say? I'm trying to think of an example of to the contrary, but I can't think of one right now. It's overwhelmingly, it's safe to say, the Supreme Court has voted in favor of attempts to curtail voting rights.
They're almost all 5-4 decisions. It's the 5 Republican justices and the 4 Democratic justices. So that was the vote on striking down the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. That was the vote on voter purges. That's the vote on political gerrymandering. That was the vote on the census, although Roberts switched, and I think we know pretty much literally at the last minute, he switched to strike down the census question. Based on this last term, there were 3 or 4 big cases where Roberts voted with the 4 liberals, which is pretty unusual. I think that makes the Louisiana abortion case, the DACA case, the Title VII case involving discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation and transgender status. That was actually 6-3. Gorsuch also voted with the liberals. There's reason to think that Roberts is very sensitive to the political environment. He understands that lots of people on the left are talking about court reform. Some crazy left-wing law professors like me are talking about actually expanding the size of the court, which I'm pretty convinced Democrats need to do. And he would definitely like to prevent that from happening. So I think it's hard to tell how he's going to vote because he's quite conservative. His ideological impulses are very conservative. He's not a moderate like Justice Kennedy or Justice O'Connor or Justice Powell, who are the swing votes before. But he also is sensitive both to his historical reputation and to the court's institutional stature. And I think those are very much at risk because, you know, Democrats were... the Scalia seat was stolen from Democrats. It was flat out stolen. Nothing like that's ever happened before in history. And I think it would be entirely justifiable for Democrats to say, you know, we've won six of the last seven popular votes in the presidency. We were entitled to fill the Scalia seat. And if that means expanding the size of the court, we need to do it. And indeed, we should do it because the Republicans will do it the second they think it's to their advantage to do it. You know, they're the ones who've been playing all the hardball in the last couple of decades. And Mitch McConnell would not hesitate, you know, if Justice Ginsburg, God save us, died the day before the inauguration.
He'd find a way.
Yeah. And so, you know, the main argument against doing what is called court packing or court reform is that if Democrats do it, then Republicans will do it. But the response to that is, first of all, the Republicans are the ones who did it. McConnell shrunk the size of the court for a year and then expanded it once a Republican was president. But in addition, Republicans will do it whether Democrats will do it or not. So what are we waiting for? And if, you know, if Democrats do, one of the lessons of the paper is supposed to be Democrats need to entrench democracy. Democrats are up against it in every area of voting. I mean, their campaign finance, you know, most of the billionaires are on the right. Voting, you know, geographic districting harms Democrats because Democrats have lots of wasted votes in cities. The Senate is massively disadvantageous to Democrats and the electoral colleges, too. Democrats need to fix that. They need to make it easier to vote, make sure everybody votes, do away with gerrymandering, make new states so that the Senate is not so extremely disadvantageous. And those things are going to get worse. So this may be the only opportunity to do it. If Biden wins and Democrats take the Senate, they may never have another chance. The Senate may never be in Democratic control, given the demographic shifts with people moving to cities and the least, you know, the least populous states getting exactly the same power in the Senate as any other state. You know, the demographic projections are by 2040, 70% of the country will live in the 15 largest states. That's 15 states electing 30 senators and the rest of the country electing 70 senators. And now, given the correlation between sparse population and Republican predisposition, the Democrats in that scenario will never win the Senate. And that's just ridiculous. I mean, there was never any good argument for every state having the same two senators, and there certainly isn't now.
You've already gotten into this somewhat, but in your article, you explain why people who are hoping for the Supreme Court to save us are probably putting their hope in a in a pipe dream, and that this institution, at least, will not save us. Can you explain why you think that the Supreme Court is not going to be something that will stop the worst impulses of Trump should he be reelected in 2020?
So I think there are two different sorts of reasons to talk about. One is that the Supreme Court has never been the romantic defender of minority rights that it's cracked up to be. And the main reason for that is that the justices are part of the contemporary culture and the same historical moment. So they didn't strike down Japanese American internment during World War II. They didn't strike down red baiting during the first or second Red Scare after World War I or in the 1950s. That's just not what the Supreme, and they didn't strike down the Muslim trial ban. That's the first point. It's just, you know, the Supreme Court didn't protect women before the second wave feminism in the 1970s. The Supreme Court didn't protect gay rights before the gay rights movement took off in the 1990s and 21st century. The Supreme Court didn't strike down segregation or black disenfranchisement during the Jim Crow era. They waited until after World War II. To decide Brown. So that's just a point about how the Supreme Court is somehow not apart from the predominant culture and historical moment. The second point is that the Supreme Court justices have ideological views, just like you and I do, and it's not like their legal interpretations are somehow apart from that. That's a separate point. You know, the Muslim trial ban was a 5-4 decision. The liberal justices had no trouble figuring out, because Trump didn't even try to hide it, that this is about hatred of Muslims. I mean, it was just as open and notorious as you could be. I hate Muslims. They hate us. I'm going to try to bar them from the country. I'm going to have my lawyers launder the executive order so it might possibly survive judicial scrutiny. And the five Republican justices said, yeah, that's good enough for us. We're not going to second guess the president.
It does seem like conservatives on the court have spent a lot of time the past 3.5 years pretending they can't see the obvious.
Yes. And, you know, on the census question, Chief Justice Roberts said, he quoted, it's a great quotation from the judge he clerked for, one of the great judges who never sat on the Supreme Court, Judge Friendly, on the Second Circuit. And I can't get the quote exactly, but it's something like, you know, judges are not somehow required to show a naivety to refuse to see things that are plain to the eyes of everybody else. And he cited that in the census case, but he could have cited it just as well in the travel ban case. You know, it is standard Hornbook constitutional law that you don't get to have as your motive for something religious or racial animus. And Trump just said as clearly as you could want during the campaign on his website as president that this is about the fact that Muslims hate us and we need to keep them out of the country. And he said it. I just want to, you know, after that terrorist attack in San Bernardino in December 2015, I want to shut down all Muslim immigration. Now, that would obviously be unconstitutional. So he had Giuliani and some of his other lawyers launder it. But the Supreme Court's not required to defer to that, yet they did.
You spoke earlier about how Chief Justice Roberts is very concerned with his legacy and the respectability of the court and civility, and that's reflected in some of his votes with liberal justices this year. But I think it's also fair to say that I think in about all four of those cases, Justice Roberts made some reference to the outright fabrications or falsehoods by the Trump administration. And it seems like those basically precluded him from going ahead and voting with the rest of the conservative court, which makes you wonder if perhaps in a different administration or in a different case where those extremely obvious lies aren't present, if he would have easily gone the other way.
So I agree with that. Let me say a couple things if I can remember in response to that. First of all, it's absolutely true that a more clever, strategic, somebody capable of self-control but with equally authoritarian inclinations would be a much more effective authoritarian than Trump. So that's reason for tremendous concern. I don't have any doubt that Tom Cotton or Mike Pompeo or probably Josh Hawley, all of whom clearly have aspirations to run for president, would be a lot more effective politically at, you know, they wouldn't be pathological lying. They would lie more strategically and they wouldn't be so openly misogynistic. And they wouldn't be so obviously incompetent. They wouldn't say you should be swallowing disinfectant to deal with the epidemic. They wouldn't be so obviously incompetent. That's right. So, you know, the danger does not disappear with Trump. And part of the point I was making in that Law Review Forward is that the problem is much deeper than Trump. Trump is a symptom more than he is the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is a sickness that has taken over the Republican Party, and that's not going to disappear with Trump. The other point is, you know, it may be true that Roberts was willing to call the administration on its lies. That's really troubling that four other Republican-appointed justices were not, and they just seem all in pretty much with the administration. Roberts has been willing to do this on a couple of occasions before, so he did do this with the ACA case where he voted with the liberals to uphold the Affordable Care Act in 2012. But again, that was another switch that we know was made at the last minute, that we know he was leaning the other direction. It was made in a presidential election. And so he's acting strategically. And if I'm a proponent of the progressive agenda, which I am, I'm not prepared to make it rise or fall with Roberts's calculations as to how much conservative policymaking he can get away with. The other point I would simply make is, you didn't mention this, but you know, if Trump had 60% approval ratings and were likely to be reelected, I'm not sure any of those cases would have come out the way they did. You know, the justices are very sensitive to that sort of thing. Harry Truman lost the Steele seizure case because he had the lowest approval ratings in history. Mm. And Nixon was a week away from resigning when he lost the tapes case. If Trump had 60% approval ratings and had a 90% chance on 538 of being reelected, I'm not sure that these cases, certainly not the DACA case, would come out the other way. And probably the same thing with the census case. So I don't think they sit around thinking about this, but they're just not oblivious to the fact that a president's more powerful when his approval ratings are not in the low 40s, which is what Trump's are.
Yeah, out of all the government agencies in the United States, I think I'd wager that the Supreme Court has the best branding out of all of them. Because despite the obvious political nature of much of what happens, they have managed to keep this ivory tower air about them. And not in like a negative elitist kind of way, but in a, they are a neutral arbiter of justice and we can trust them to do what's right and not political. And their approval ratings are definitely far higher than I think anything else in government are just about. And that of blind faith and not blind faith, but very blinkered faith in Supreme Court does seem like a danger given the current moment.
So I totally agree with that. I wouldn't limit it to the current moment. I mean, you know, Chief Justice Roberts could stand up in his confirmation hearings and talk about how judging is like calling balls and strikes for a baseball umpire. And I think anybody who takes con law or teaches con law certainly knows it's nothing like that. I mean, why do they divide 5-4 based on political ideology on almost every subject matter that they resolve? It's true about abortion. It's true about affirmative action. It's true about campaign finance reform. It's true about gun control and the Second Amendment. It's true about everything. Why is that? Well, it's not because one set of them is following the law and the other set is doing politics. It's because all judging is inevitably political in the sense that there are lots of open questions. There are lots of conflicting methodologies. There are lots of conflicting interpretive moves that you can make as a lawyer, right? There are always arguments. You're bound by precedent, except you're not really bound by precedent. You can overturn precedent, or you can distinguish precedent, or, you know, you can stick with what is tradition, but you can depart from tradition. There are just always arguments on both sides. So of course your ideology is going to affect you. And that's always been true. You know, when the justices decided Dred Scott in 1857, the Northern justices and Southern justices had different views about whether the Missouri Compromise, which barred slavery in federal territories, was unconstitutional. And when they discussed Brown at their first conference in 1952, before reaching a unanimous outcome, the Northern justices and Southern justices actually differed about whether school segregation was unconstitutional. The difference now is not that their own ideological or political views matter. It's that they're as ideologically divided as the country is. And that just wasn't true. We weren't that ideologically divided 60 years ago. You know, 60 years ago when the Republican Party nominated a nutcase for president, he lost by 20 percentage points. But when the Republican Party nominated a nutcase for president in 2016, he won the Electoral College and he only lost the popular vote by 2 points. That's largely a function of the extent to which we've become polarized. And the justices also have become polarized so that they don't live in the same world. So Justice Alito, you know, is outraged that the court would strike down the census question and talk about the motivation. You know, the Commerce Secretary is the one responsible for the census, just flat out lied. He just lied to Congress. He just made up a story about why they were asking the citizenship question. And Justice Alito not only said, should we defer to that, he was outraged that they were willing to question the motive. And the same thing in the Muslim trial ban case. You know, the conservatives, who were the majority, just thought, how dare you question the president's motive? We don't do that. So, you know, they're living in different worlds, just like Trump voters are living in a world where 75% of Republicans think he's done a great job with regard to the pandemic, whereas 2/3 of Americans understand it's been a catastrophe. But 75% of Republicans think he's done a fine job. We don't live in the same world, and Supreme Court justices don't live in the same world as each other anymore. That's a huge problem. And it can't be that the progressive agenda has to stand and fall on whether the Chief Justice is calculating, well, if I do this, there's going to be repercussions, but if I do that, I can get away with it. Right? Something needs to be done about that. And it's not like Democrats don't have a really strong, legitimate claim to control the court. It was stolen from them. That literally what happened never happened before in American history, what Mitch McConnell did.
In your foreword, you end with a case for pessimism and a case for optimism. I think the pessimism part we all unfortunately get right now, but what reasons do we have to be optimistic going forward?
There are a number of reasons to be optimistic. So the demographics are all in favor of the younger, more diverse, more tolerant, progressive agenda. If we just took a referendum and everybody over 18 had to vote, like in Australia, the Republicans would be wiped out. They'd never win another national election, and they know that unless they change their policies. So we are going to move in a much more racially tolerant, religiously tolerant, and I think more supportive of doing something about rampant economic inequality. We're going to move in that direction. College students, there was a poll of college students, and Trump loses to Biden by 50 points. It's something like 70 to 20. Now, those are well-educated people, but it's also the younger generation. And, you know, the younger generation thoroughly repudiates their parents and grandparents' homophobia. They're almost all, you know, I that's been true for 15 years. I've taken polls of students at the University of Virginia and Harvard. My law students have been supportive of same-sex marriage for 15 years, even at a time that the Supreme Court never would have done it. So that's one reason to be optimistic. There's another reason, which is the way political change often, and social change too in the United States, often happens is through a kind of pendulum movement, which produces backlash and counter-backlash. And that's actually how the civil rights movement scored some of its biggest victories in the 1960s. And I think there's a lot of evidence of that happening with regard to Trump. To some extent, Trump was a product of backlash against Obama with the greater racial resentment accumulating within the Republican Party. But there's been a huge backlash against Trump. We saw that in the 2018 elections. Democrats overcame their systematic disadvantages in the House and won a majority. They won 40 seats. That's very difficult to do today, given the gerrymandering against Democrats and given the geographic sorting, which works to the disadvantage of Democrats. There is a big backlash brewing. And, you know, even though Nate Silver on 538 says Trump still has just under a 30% chance of winning, he actually has a bigger chance of losing in a landslide than he does of winning. And if he loses in a landslide, Democrats might actually be able to do some really impressive stuff. You see that with race, too. I mean, the Black Lives Matter is much more popular than it was 5 or 6 years ago. And a lot of that is backlash against Trump's open racism. I certainly never thought, you know, being old enough to sort of vaguely remember George Wallace, I never thought there was any chance George Wallace could be elected president. And there wasn't. But Trump is effectively George Wallace. I mean, he's almost as openly racist as George Wallace was. I mean, talking about how Biden will destroy the suburbs. I mean, that's just, you know, you'd have to come from another planet to not understand what he's saying there. So I do think there's a backlash. I think it's almost a race of time. Can the Republicans suppress enough votes to offset the demographics, which work against them every election? Every election, the electorate is 2% less white. And that 2% is voting 75 or 80% Democratic. Can you use your advantage in the Electoral College and in the, you know, in the House and the voter suppression, the voter ID laws and the voter purges and the gerrymandering? Can you somehow outrun those demographics? And I think at some point it's going to catch up to them. And if Democrats then entrench democracy, the Republicans have no choice but to try to reform themselves. Also, you know, one point we should never forget, the United States does have a more entrenched democracy than countries like Hungary and Turkey and Poland, which have moved really far in an authoritarian direction. And then there's also the point we alluded to earlier. Trump has low approval ratings. He's always had low approval ratings. He's been mostly in a band of 40 to 45%. Occasionally he was below that. He's almost never been above that. If you did the approval ratings of, you know, Modi in India, or Orban in Hungary, they're much more popular and they're also much shrewder. They're much smarter, they're much more strategic, they're much more able to restrain themselves. So, you know, we ought to count our blessings in a way that even though we got stuck with Trump for 4 years, and that's not a very flattering portrait of the American electorate, at least, you know, he won because people didn't show up. You know, there was a lot of, you know, morning after regret. I can't believe I didn't vote and I might be responsible for that. And people aren't likely to make that mistake again. So I'm pretty optimistic how the election's going to turn out. I'm not totally confident that there won't end up being some violence because I think Trump, you know, he only cares about himself. And
I felt like in terms of pure votes, in terms of pure normal election stuff, for lack of a better word, I do feel optimistic. However, it doesn't seem like we're headed for any kind of normal election. And my concern is that right now, that whatever happens, Trump can cause enough confusion and enough controversy to make it a Supreme Court issue. Once it becomes a Supreme Court issue, well, it just feels like reliving Bush v. Gore all over again.
Right. We've all seen that movie before, and we know if there are five Republicans on the Supreme Court, Democrats are likely to come on the short end of a Supreme Court decision. So there are a number of ways that Democrats are fighting an uphill battle. Nate Silver pointed out just last week that if Biden wins by 2-3% in the popular vote, he is less than 50% likely to win the Electoral College. He needs to win by more than 3 percentage points in the popular vote to have more than a 50% chance. And he needs to win by more than 5% before he has a 90% chance. I think if he gets up to a 6% win in the popular vote, then he gets up to 98%, 99%. So that's the first hurdle, is you need to not only win, you need to win by a significant margin to win the Electoral College. Then we all know if the Electoral College is close that Trump will not just walk away. He will claim it was stolen from him. He will claim on election night that he won and that Democratic secretaries of state are cheating when the late counted absentee ballots come in. So there's a chance that Trump will just refuse to concede. And I don't see any Republican politicians standing up to him. They haven't stood up to him on anything else. So I don't see any senior statesman except Mitt Romney saying, well, you lost. And then even if he loses by a lot, I don't think he can pull that if he loses by 8 or 10 points. I think then he will lose. But I don't know that he's not going to incite his supporters, who believe all sorts of crazy QAnon conspiracy theories and already think it's the end of the world if Biden wins and think there's a great conspiracy against Trump and the devil-worshipping pedophiles are going to take over the world. I don't know, those people aren't going to show up in Washington, D.C. carrying their semi-automatic rifles and start some violence. So I hope that's not true. I wouldn't bet that that's true, but is it implausible? No, of course it's not implausible. I mean, and if it's close, then it's a disaster, right? Because it'll end up in litigation and it'll end up, you know, at the end of the day, the military has to make a call. Is Trump really president? Is Trump not president? I don't think he can do a coup. The military made it really clear during the violence in June that they're not going to support Trump in a coup. But what if it's not clear who really is president, right? What if some state that, you know, what if in Pennsylvania, it's pretty clear that Biden won, but the Republican legislature just sends a competing set of electors to Congress? I don't know what happens at that point. And if it's a litigated case to the Supreme Court, I have no doubt that the Supreme Court will figure out a way that the Republicans really won. And, you know, what's the military supposed to do at that point? They're not going to support a coup, but if it's not clear who won, they have to make a choice. And what's that choice going to be? I mean, we have no precedent for any of this. I'd like to believe that, you know, we're still a sufficiently sound, competent, working society, but there's a lot of evidence that we're not, right? The coronavirus is really good evidence that we don't live in the same world anymore.
Well, this morning, I did see an interview with a journalist who was interviewing like one of these bicycle gangs, and they're like, yeah, we'll take up arms if that's what it takes. And certainly I think Trump is going to, and he's going to call for that. I don't, whether or not people want to show up on their own, he's going to call for that. And right now, as of last count, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center said there's like 1,500, you know, white supremacist groups that are like, that actually exist. And it doesn't take a lot of people to cause a lot of chaos. But Susan raised another terrifying specter, I think, in the last show we had, which is, let's say he loses and he concedes, he might just run again in 2024.
That could be our best outcome, actually. That could actually be like the most optimistic scenario here that we're
facing. Should just let him know, listen, we'll let you run again. Maybe he'll go away then.
Well, if he doesn't, one reason why he can't go away now, why he can't relinquish power, is because it's likely he's going to be prosecuted criminally, right? And he knows that. So he's going to be, you might have to make a deal that Joe Biden promises to pardon him if he leaves office. If he doesn't run again, it's pretty clear his son will run again. The New York Times podcast had a really good piece on Donald Trump Jr., who's now just a hero in the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah.
nebbiest circles.
Well, yeah, the good news there is that we won't have to worry about a smart and incompetent authoritarian.
That's right. Yeah. Right. There's going to be QAnon representatives in Congress.
Yeah. Now. Whether Trump wins or loses, there will be QAnon people in D.C. because they'll be in government.
The RNC chair, Rahm McDaniel, is refusing to repudiate them. She's on board with this. And Steve Scalise is apparently on board with this. So the Republican Party has largely lost its mind. They're not going to stand up and say, oh, yeah, Trump lost. He needs to walk away now. And, you know, you're not allowed to, the intelligence community, the FBI is apparently not allowed to talk to Trump about the right-wing terrorists in the country because he gets upset. He doesn't want to hear about it. The same way you're not allowed to talk to him about 2020 Russian interference with the election. The intelligence people literally have been told, Kyrsten Sinema, I think when she was still Secretary of Homeland Security, was trying to get a meeting with the president, and Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, said, no, you can't talk to him about that. It upsets him. So you're not allowed to talk to the president about how these crazy right-wing conspiracy groups are the main terrorist threat in the country because he gets upset because they vote for him and he thinks they're super patriots and he likes anyone who votes for him. That's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, probably those people are under control while Trump's president, but when Trump loses, who knows what they're going to do?
Yeah, it does seem like the idea of a smooth transition of power is, I don't want to say off the table, but it feels that way sometimes.
I don't want to be overly pessimistic. I mean, I do think if I were betting, I would say, you know, Biden's going to win by a significant enough margin that Trump won't be able to claim plausibly it was stolen. I do think Trump will go down fighting. He doesn't care about anything but himself. So if he can rile up his base, he'll be happy to do that. And at that point, who knows? I mean, we've never had anything like this before. You saw all those, you know, militia people from rural Michigan show up at the state house. They intimidated the legislature out of holding a session. And as many people have pointed out, if there were Black people carrying semi-automatic rifles, you know, they would have been shot dead by the police. But these guys are deferred to, and the police actually, you know, give them fist bumps and, you know, more power to you. That's a scary set of circumstances. I don't think we've had that in this country before. I don't think anybody knows for sure that we're not going to have some violence. And, you know, but again, you asked about reasons for being optimism. You know, if Democrats entrench democracy, you know, if they make sure everybody can vote, if they have automatic voter registration, if they make Election Day a national holiday, if they do away with, you know, mandatory IDs, which are difficult for, you know, people who are disabled or people who don't drive cars to get access to. If Democrats do all that, it'll be a different voting population. And this craziness will subside because the Republican Party will reinvent itself as the party that it, you know, historically was, which was not a crazy party, but a party of business and a party, you know, that was more inclined to cut taxes, but not a party that believed in white supremacy, not a party that believed in Christian nationalism, not a party that believed that, you know, the richest 1% should be given a larger share of the GDP. I mean, the party's lost its mind, and that needs to be fixed. And it would be fixed if everybody voted and you could do something about all the money that the Koch brothers pour into politics on the Republican side.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was extremely illuminating. If, and knock on wood, Biden does win the election, I would love to have you on to make the case for why he needs to expand Supreme Court, because I do at this point. I've reluctantly come around. I felt very much the other way. But I think at this point, I agree. I don't see another path forward.
I agree with that. I would not have supported this until the last couple of years. But it seems to me that there's the arguments against it just are easy to refute, I think. Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to come back. It's fun chatting with you guys.
Professor Klarman, are you on social media? Is there anywhere our listeners can follow you online?
No, I'm too old to tweet. you can email me. I answer my emails. mklarman@law.harvard.edu. And I like answering emails. Happy to do that, but I don't tweet.
And we'll post a link to your article in the show notes. It is long, but seriously worth a read, guys. Check it out.
Thank you. Thank you so
much. Thanks very much for having
me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.